Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome all to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. Just this afternoon, November 17, 2020, we're covering a book review on The Property Species, Mine, Yours, and the Human Mind. I'm Nick Marr, Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our experts. And we're fortunate to have with us today, We're fortunate to have with us today Timothy Sandifer. He's Vice President for Litigation at the Goldwater Institute. Tim's going to introduce our main speaker, the author of our book today, and then he's going to moderate a bit of a discussion for about a half hour. After that, we're going to move to audience questions, so be thinking of those as we go along and have them in mind for when we get to that portion of the call. All right, thanks very much for being with us here today, Tim. I'll give the floor off to you.
Thanks so much, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this conversation with Professor Bart Wilson and to discuss his new book on private property, which I was really eager to talk about, and I'm happy to have Professor Wilson with us. Professor Wilson is the Duncan Kennedy Endowed Chair of Economics and Law at my own alma mater, Chapman University, and is a founding member of the Economics Science Institute and of the and is the founding member and director of the Smith Institute for Political Economy and Philosophy. It's all very impressive, and what I'm particularly interested in is the way that Professor Wilson combines law, economics, philosophy, and anthropology in his studies. So welcome, Professor Wilson. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Now, I think it's fair to say that your focus is on experimental economics. Is that the term that you would use?
Yes, that's my training, and that's kind of my core academic work.
And what is experimental economics for those who might not be familiar with that term?
So it's a laboratory method of inquiry where we build models of the world, economic models of the world, and we pay undergraduates to participate in them to see how well they conform or fail to conform with our theories in economics. And so the better decisions they make, the more money they earn. And that's their incentive to participate. And we learn more or less how institutions work and what are the formal and informal ways that lead us to cooperate and achieve gains from trade.
Is there a difference between this and behavioral economics, another term that you often hear nowadays?
Yeah, so behavioral economics is a little more psychology oriented, and I think it's a way of incorporating behavioral economics with economics. Experimental economics kind of grew out of a tradition of looking at markets and how they work and how well they work. One of the pioneers, Vernon Smith, won the Nobel Prize for his contributions to experimental economics in 2002, and he shared that with Danny Kahneman, who is kind of one of the major founders, and you think of behavioral economics, and he's a psychologist, and so I think that kind of distinguishes the two a bit.
I noticed, because you and Professor Smith and others of this bent talk a lot about the work of Adam Smith and the other Scottish Enlightenment philosophers, you think you're working in the tradition of the Smithian, Humean tradition, philosophically speaking?
Most definitely. There was a way of making sense of our experiments Vernon started it in the 1990s. I was still just getting out of grad school then. In the 2000s, really seeing how what we're observing in the laboratory was all kind of coming to was already very much present in the 1700s, and that their way of thinking about the world helped us make sense of these experiments that we were running.
Now, I'll tell you why I was so drawn to your book and why I was so excited to have an opportunity to talk with you is that, you know, when we talk about property, we so often, especially we lawyers, we get caught up in talking about legal precedents, or if those of an economic bent get caught up in talking about gains from trade and opportunity cost, and sometimes it gets very jargony and technical. And instead, it looks to me from your book like you are really getting more into the anthropology and the psychology and I want to say the behavioral psychology or the evolutionary psychology of property that is, you know, a more fundamental even than the sort of things that lawyers and political philosophers talk about.
Yeah, what really kind of crystallized the project for me was when I posed the question to myself of what it is and why is it that humans have property? And to think about it, what is it that's universal about it and what is it that's not universal about property? And so for me to do that, I needed to think through what, you know, what is common to all human beings and how property might vary from groups of people. And so that very much led me to need to kind of work in read up in anthropology and in primatology in particular, which I had been working with a primatologist at Georgia State, Sarah Brodson, for quite some time. And so I kind of had been got into the literature that way through her.
So now, of course, other animals do have something like property. They have possessiveness. They try and divide themselves, separate themselves from the world with a rudimentary concept of mine and not mine. But you say that human beings go a step further than that.
Yeah. So, yeah. All animals have acquisitiveness in the sense that we all need food, and we all need mates in order to reproduce, and we all need many animals need tools in order to acquire these other things in the world. And so acquisitiveness, yes, is the common feature, but I want to make a distinction of how we actually perceive the world, and that's very different of than, say, our dogs or chimpanzees or even scrub jays or any other kind of animal. And so it's not just in the wanting to acquire something and to keep it from some other animal trying to dispossess us of it, that there's something more going on in our minds when we acquire something and then how we settle the rules in order for deciding who gets to have that stuff.
And you use this term when you talk about that in the book, you use this phrase that I found very striking, and that is that we pour ourselves into property, pour as in P-O-U-R, like pouring a glass of milk or something. So you say that we pour ourselves into property. What do you mean by that?
So I would argue that's not kind of the pre-human parts of that we might share with chimpanzees is there. And so, but what's the distinction with pouring into? That's a great question. So part of my argument is that property comes through the use of tools. And so and many animals use tools, chimpanzees in particular. Let me take a close cousin. If you take a big stick and they'll poke it in a termite heel to feel where that open chamber is. And they can't, you know, the termites don't make that easy. You got to have them prod around. But they can feel through the end of the tip of that club when they've felt that open chamber. And so they can make that deduction. Now, and then the great thing, kind of the brilliance of it, they pull out that big club and they'll stick in the little tool to a little thin reed in order to have the termites come out one by one so they don't swarm them and then pick them off and eat them. So that kind of feeling through a tool, chimpanzees can do that. What I argue humans do is that we put ourselves into that thing. Like our minds have the abstract power to feel through the tool. And so take this kind of example I got from Michael Polanyi's book, Personal Knowledge. If you take a cane, close your eyes, and you knock around, you're walking through, you feel the leg of the table through the cane. Now, the actual sensations are the club, the cane in your palm of your hand, but your mind has reorganized that because your goal is feeling out what's at the end of that. And so your mind reorganizes as if you're feeling the tip of the cane when you're not. So that's kind of the first step. And the rudiments of that are we seem to be quite clear are also in chimpanzees. Then I think the trick is, what happens when we put that down? Now, when a chimpanzee puts down the stick, they kind of move on and another one picks it up, so whatever. But when we have a tool that we've made and we've created and we put that thing down, we tend to act as if we're still in it. And that's kind of what I mean by it, that we've abstracted to the thing to have this other concept, which I call mind, in there, that the mind has become part of the very thing itself.
You know, in reading the section of your book on this, it reminded me of a passage in another book by a philosopher I admire a lot named Jacob Bronowski. He wrote a long book called The Ascent of Man. It's sort of a history of science and the history of human evolution. And in a part, there's this one part where he's in a cave, and he's talking about cave paintings that cavemen drew. And he says that he thinks this is kind of the moment when we became human, because it was the moment when we became capable of symbolic abstraction, and that enabled us to imagine the future, where, you know, you paint on the side of the cave, you paint what tomorrow's hunt is going to look like, as a way of sort of imagining what it's going to be like tomorrow, as a way of addressing your fears about tomorrow's hunt or something. And his argument is that what's distinctive about the human mind is this ability to sort of project things and use symbols to project them. Is that kind of a similar line of what you have in mind?
Yes. In fact, I mean, and I came to that through the neuroanthropologist Terence Deacon, who makes that argument, and then the linguist Derek Bickerton, that symbolic thought is this ability to think outside the here and now. And that is the feature that really kind of distinguishes us from the rest of the animal kingdom. And that's not a minor trick. And it's, I think, important to my argument and important to understanding of all the great things that human beings can do. And that is to be able to think outside the here and now. And that's, your example is exactly talking about outside the here and now, the hunt. So Derek Bickerton argues that this process probably got set in place maybe 2 million years ago, when they start to see this change in the archaeological record, where the hominins were getting to these bones and scavenging them after the big cats. They were like six genera of these things in the savanna, and you see them breaking the bones open to get the marrow inside, and then it switches.
I'm imagining that opening scene in 2001 with the apes breaking the.
Yeah. And there's something really interesting, that it switches, and it seems like the hominins are getting to these things, to these carcasses, before the cats. And now, these hominins don't have claws, they don't have the same fangs, so that means there's something kind of this coordination going on there for them all to kind of harvest this big hunk of food out there. And so Bickerton makes the case that now, to coordinate going over there versus over there, that could be the pressure that would get those first concepts off the ground, that would get you out of the here and now. To think like, no, and we got to coordinate. Like, we got to go that way. I've seen a dead carcass over there. Let's kind of coordinate on moving over there. And then also to kind of do that around this big carcass to keep away the predators. And so once those first concepts kind of get off the ground, in a sense, or released from the here and now, then all these other things become possible. And so, like, part of my argument is that sometime, 70,000 to 100,000 years ago, kind of speculation, when kind of you see these great symbolic powers, like you are mentioning, with cave paintings and stuff like that, come up into being. This concept of mind is one of those abstract concepts that is there, that stands outside the here and now, and then we can use that to organize ourselves in our relationships with each other involving things.
And it does seem like there's a distinctly human capacity, and it particularly comes about in children at a fairly early age, when we really start to imagine and project mental states onto other people and things, right? We have plush animals when we're little children, teddy bears, that we give personalities to, and we imagine that they are distinct things that can think on their own and have a personality other than, it's separate from my own personality when I imagine it. And that seems to be a very notable distinction between us and the other animals. And you see that as being part of this process of owning things, or as you put it, putting mine into things.
Well, right. So that's part of the story of my putting myself into a thing. But in order for that system to work, I also have to reciprocally recognize that other things are yours. And that involves understanding their minds, and that we are jointly attending to this idea that these things are mine and those things are yours. And other people are saying those things are yours and these things are mine. And so, yes, being able to understand that we're jointly intending to these things is a key part of how I think property works. And also that is just not there in any other primates. Michael Tomasello makes the case that joint attention is not really there in chimpanzees. We can think in terms of I and a bunch of I's all going out at the same time, but we think in we. And when we are both thinking about a certain thing, and I call it mine, and you recognize that as your, they use the concept yours to say that's mine, that those two things have to go together, and we have to have our minds on the same page in order to do that. And that's not that's a major trick in the animal kingdom that you have to see elsewhere.
And you say that this is a very unique feature of human beings, is that we are capable of recognizing that there are ways, improper ways to acquire things, that there's wrong ways to gain objects, and that we are capable of recognizing when something I might desire it, but it doesn't belong to me.
Yes. So the other part of the other key abstract concept is not. And so when we teach kids how they can acquire things, it's often through the word no. Yeah. They pick it up, they go into something, no. Kids go in the grocery store, I think almost it's kind of one of those universal rites of passage. You walk through, there's, you see all this great stuff all over the place, and you just want to grab it and take it. And what do we hear? We hear no.
Right.
We have to be taught that things just lying around aren't ours to pick up and discover.
And what would you say are the grounds on which we learn not to acquire? What are the bases on which we make the conclusion that it is improper to acquire something in a certain way?
Well, that rests on accepting parents and guardians as our mentors, and that they pass on that authority. They have that authority to tell us and guide us, and we accept that from them as their mentors. And then we gradually learn kind of what the community standards are for claiming things as mine and yours.
Do you think that it's just community standards? Are there community standards that might be generally accepted but are nevertheless wrong?
Do you have an example?
Let's take two. So the first one is, I was reminded at the same time that I was reading your book, I was rereading the old classic libertarian book, The Discovery of Freedom by Rose Wilder Lane. Now, Lane was the daughter of Laura Ingalls Wilder, and Ghost wrote the Little House on the Prairie books, but she was also a really prominent anti-New Deal writer, and she was one of the founding mothers of libertarian political philosophy as we know it. And she had traveled a lot in the Balkans. In fact, she fell in love with the Balkans, and she wanted to move there for some time, even bought a house there, ended up failing because of the Great Depression. She has a passage in her book where she talks about this incident where she was traveling with some tribesmen and came across a scene where these tribesmen were trying to force this widow out of her house. She was a member of the tribe. She lived in this house all her life with her husband. Her husband had now died, and she wanted to live in this house still. And the tribesmen were taking it away from her because they said there was no reason for her to have a house that had three or four rooms in it when she was only one person and only needed one room. And as Lane describes it, this widow argued with the tribal leaders for a great deal of time, saying, I built this house myself. My husband and I built this with our own bare hands. It belongs to us. It's wrong for you to take it. And what I'm puzzled about in this is using this example is how would you say that there's any ground, any legitimate argument that the widow could make that would substantiate her claim to the house?
So, well, this idea of you creating something and then being able to call it mine, I think that's probably very universal in tools. And so I think that's that the general form of how property works is if we create something, we make a tool in the world. In this case, you know, a home is a tool for shelter. That is kind of a universal phenomenon. And what that scene is that you're describing, that story, is one where that is at odds with whatever the community is trying to also setting the standards for it. And kind of that. I do think there's something very instinctual about it, and that's why I would say that it seems to appear that we're putting ourselves in our things that we create, that we would get that we get quite riled up, quite offended if somebody tries to take something within our grasp, things particularly that we create them. So I think that would be that's a very ancient idea, and I would argue goes back to kind of where property started. And I think that sounds like what she's channeling. The conflict is the other people in the community don't seem to agree with her on that. Right. And so now we get to the crux of how do we settle that dispute.
Right. And that I think that's where I had some qualms about the book, because it seems like the argument only comes up to this sort of, you know, positive, descriptive tone of saying, well, this is what would happen is that there would be a conflict. But when we take that next step and say, what are the merits of each side's argument in this dispute? How does this sort of anthropological / experimental economics approach answer that question?
But all of that relies on all these other customs of how disputes are handled and settled. And I think that's beyond my project, in a sense, of integrating those two things. I think it sets a kind of a new research program to think about those things. Mm-hmm. My interest in kind of writing the book was to get people to be concerned about all these ancient things, the way we think about it, that has to be accounted for when we talk about property, as opposed to thinking about it only in the modern kind of democratic concepts of rights, which seem to me not clearly grounded in these very basic human ways of thinking about property.
Yeah, and you say right at the beginning of the book, you say, I'm going to use the term property, and I'm not using the term property rights. And maybe you could elaborate a little bit on why that is. Why is it that you think that using the term property rights might be a little misleading?
Well, so property – I see property rights as what you need and what arises at the level of a poly, of dealing with a bunch of disparate groups and communities that are all kind of linked together in a way. And I'm not – dismissing that's not important. In fact, that's exactly how poly is going to make it work. But I'm arguing that how that system of property rights would work at that level is dependent upon very community standards and then also how the individual interacts with the community. And that's the part that I want to add into the discussion. It's such that and it also when we talk about property rights, it tends to have a very top-down language to it, that they get imposed on the people. And I think the way property started in human beings and how it grows is very much going bidirectional. It's my mind to the community and the community affecting my mind. And now if you're going to put all these communities next to each other and then have that connected with some kind of political system of coordinating and settling disputes, that edifice rests on this very basic level of the individual interacting with their community. And so also I think the word rights is used many different ways. I think economists use the word property right very differently than lawyers. I mean, economists even start adding other modifiers to it to call them economic property rights versus legal property rights. And I'm just not clear exactly what those things mean. And so I'm trying to get at a real basic level and build up at a, and so I would think of my book as preceding a discussion of what property rights are.
Yeah, right. Because it would sort of beg the question for you to start with property rights and then talk about the caveman and so forth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, this comes to mind, of course, because, and this is the second example, is what about slavery? I mean, there have to be grounds on which we can say that there are certain forms of property, so-called, that are illegitimate at all times and in all places. And I think, I mean, you mentioned slavery briefly in the book, and you say this, that it's not a legitimate form of property. But I don't see how we can make that claim if the basis for property justification is entirely tribal. I mean, it's entirely collective. It's just whatever our society says is recognized as property is ipso facto property. Then on what grounds can we condemn something like slavery?
So I think the key part of understanding that is that if you think of property as a custom, a way a community works, then it has to fit into all the other customs of how the community works. And if our notion and customs of how we treat other human beings is changing, then how the custom of property interacts with that has to change too. And so think of property as an abstract way of I can say about something, this is mine. Other people can know that what I say is true, and no one else can say this thing is mine. If that kind of is the core of property, then what we apply it to can change and evolve over time. And so it evolved, like we decide we've come to appreciate human beings, give them liberty, dignity, and equality, that we no longer consider those people to be something you can call mine. And so that allows property to evolve as the community evolves. And so how we would get rid of slavery as a legitimate form, that's like a different question about how is it that liberty, dignity of individuals changes in a society. But that's beyond kind of the scope of what I wanted to accomplish. But I think it's important to integrate the custom of property with other customs of how we treat people in general.
So it's funny you mention this because just this morning I was working on a paper on a different subject entirely, and I pulled down – this is I have in my hand a copy of G. Edward White's book, Law in American History, Volume 1, and he's talking about colonial – New England, and he has this very interesting example. He says he says a 1651 case in the colonial court of Connecticut. Uncas, the sachem of the Mohegan tribe, which is a member of the Algonquin family of tribes, appeared in that court to represent an Indian from Long Island who had bought a canoe from a Connecticut settler. The settler had stolen that canoe from another Mohegan. After buying the canoe, the Long Island Indian had then returned it to its rightful owner, and Uncas asked the court to compel the settler to reimburse the Long Island Indian for the fee that he had paid for the canoe. And the court agreed, ordering the settler to pay the Long Island Indian 9 shillings. Now, what's really interesting to me about that is there you have a legal dispute where we have basically three cultures involved. You have the European settlers, and then you have two tribes, the Long Island tribe and the Mohegan tribe. And this, nevertheless, they are able to come to a resolution that I guess you and I could at least say that it accords with our intuitive notions of justice. And yet they are not trapped within their cultures. They resolve this dispute across cultural boundaries. And it seems to me that suggests that there has to be something about property that is deeper than our mere cultural deliberations. Does that make sense?
It makes great sense. And I would like to get the name of that author again. Sure. read that. That's fantastic. It's Law in American History.
Yes, G. Edward White, who incidentally is probably my favorite legal historian, and this is the first volume of a series of books that he's put out, three volumes now, I think, on law in American history. And this first chapter actually is all full of stories of this sort, and it's really an interesting thing to see how people can resolve these debates not by appealing to their own cultural traditions of what is right and wrong, but to something deeper and more universally human, which I think is something in the line of what you're trying to argue here.
Yes. So what I would argue is common to all three of those societies, that they have this concept of mine, and that they understand when somebody says this is mine, and they understand how that kind of moves around. And also then what are the generally accepted ways that can work or can't work. And so, when I'm using can that way, I mean that in the socially acceptable, socially conforming ways of acting. And so, yeah, I mean, as an economist, the example could be similar. It's how is it that two groups of people who can't speak even the same language can still exchange things? You go through these elaborate kind of rituals of laying things on a beach, going back to your ship, right, and then moving things around without even knowing how to converse with them, that we understand their minds, they understand our minds, and in basic core, that they understand mine and yours. And that is what's behind that process to make it work.
This is where I then run into kind of the question that I asked earlier, which is, to put it a different way. So, for example, you use a couple examples of the experiments that you've run in the laboratory and testing how students reacted to certain situations where they're trying to, you know, accumulate property and somebody figures out a way that may not be technically cheating, but is still kind of, you know, gaming the system, and they retaliate against him. And you conclude with this passage where you say that the rule arises out of the practice. Right. You say, I found it somewhere. I hear you on page 91. You say, what is right is not derived from the rule, but let the rule arise from our knowledge of what is right. But doesn't that commit the Panglossian fallacy that whatever rule happens to arise is just right because it happened to arise? And if that's the case, how is slavery not justified?
Well, I think for me, a rule is a way of settling is the dispute that needs to be that go back to the experiment kind of ground this. So this is the way I think reason why there are great places to understand these ideas is they're kind of you see them kind of emerge from the beginning. These are people thrown into a virtual world. Think of them being beamed onto a planet, and all of a sudden now they got to make sense of this. And so we can see the things shake out. And so what they bring with them are these general abstract ideas of what harm is, of taking something that was in my grasp and moving it into your grasp. But they have to live in the very specific world of these particular things, you and me and how they work. And we have to come up with what's the rule that will solve this dispute? You think that this is the way the rules should work, and I think that's a way the rules should work. And now, what is the rule that's going to make kind of put those expectations in line? And so that's what I mean. What is right are these abstract ways about what it means to harm people, treat people with dignity, and things like that. And then we have this specific situation of this particular dispute, and now we got to come up with what's the rule we should have had in mind. And these can be good faith disagreements, which they are in the case of my experiments, because they got to figure it out on their own. So they don't have to necessarily be people with nefarious plans out there. So let me give you an example, and this is very much influenced by that particular experiment, and it's one that, you know, is often I use regularly in my law school classes, and that's Bob Ellickson's work on whaling norms. And so it's what everyone knows, that if somebody's working on a whale and you go in there and try to take it away from them, that's going to, you know, create conflict. But what's the specific rule for dealing with each type of whale might change, because the situation of how you go about whaling right whales off the North Atlantic versus sperm whales off the North American coast are different. And so the rule has to come out of their experience of, well, look, you know, with right whales, as long as my harpoon's in the whale, attached to my boat, no one goes after it. But that's great because right whales don't fight, and they're the right whale to hunt because they don't sink when they die. But that rule doesn't work when you work with sperm whales. And that's what American whalers learned, that they gradually switched from that rule to one where there's iron holds the whale. As long as the harpoon's in the whale and you're in pursuit of it, it's, you can call that whale yours. And so the rule comes out of those specific circumstances in the world of hunting sperm whales versus hunting right whales. But they had a sense of what's already right, which is not, you know, damaging the whale and both of them trying to cut into it and fighting over it. And so that's what I mean why the rule has to come out of all these other notions of what we consider to be right. And so if, in the case of slavery, then, if our notions of how we treat people with dignity and liberty and equality is changing, then the rules by which you can claim things as mine are going to adapt to them. And they're no longer make it illegitimate for you to say this person is mine.
So let's see. Nick, do we have any calls or any questions from folks who might be listening in?
And for the moment right now, Tim, we don't have any audience questions. But
excellent. Well, I have a ton more questions myself, so we can keep pursuing this. And then if anybody has any as we go forward, then that would be great. So to get back this question about how these rules evolve, I think the reason why this caused me to pause is because I come to this myself with a more Aristotelian idea of how morality operates, and that sort of conflicts with the empiricist or Smithian approach, I think, that you're taking, where you're saying that these rules evolve over time. And that's just the way those rules are. And what I'm looking for is, how do we then look at the rule and say, this may be the rule and it may be universally accepted, but it's immoral or it's wrong? Do you think there is room for that step in your view?
So I'm very much a Smithian of moral philosopher kind of person. My prior book was kind of integrating experimental economics and Adam Smith's ideas into theory of moral sentiments. I don't know kind of the Aristotle's theory of morality that well in order to kind of get at the debate between those two. But the Scottish Enlightenment Project is a product of allowing it to evolve over time, that there is a sense of this is slowly changing and that the rules develop based upon kind of our relationships and what the problem at the time. So there's a reason why the rules of justice are, you know, are very precise and accurate, whereas the rules of beneficence are very loose, vague, and indeterminate. And that means that the content of those things is going to change differently. So the rules of beneficence are going to probably have a lot of degrees of freedom and change a lot, because how you're good to other people can evolve very easily. But the rules of justice, you know, murder, theft, breaking of contract, those kind of things, those tend to be more precise, and yet they still have an element to evolve too. Because in the Smithian sense, they rest on sentiments. So for Smith, resentment is this core sentiment that gets kind of the rules of justice off the ground. And so Smith has this great example where he says, well, why is it that we punish murder so much more than theft, and theft so much more than breach of contract? Because our resentment with the sympathy with the ones harmed is so much greater with murder, and less so with theft. And in breach of contract, they're not even harmed in the sense of they just have their future expectations seem to be disappointed. So Smith theory is that, look, that the resentment here is what's driving the way how much we punish. And I think that if that theory then allows why we can move to a place where we don't no longer accept capital punishment, that we still kind of have a ranking between murder and theft, but the actual punishments that we mete out are kind of tied with those core resentments, and we don't have the same resentment with murder that we're willing to, you know, execute people for it. Mm-hmm. And so that's a long way of saying that I think that the Smithian way allows things to evolve if you kind of start with these very abstract forms of how morality works and ideals, that seems to be straitjacketing kind of the human career.
Well, and at the same time, your argument isn't for taking the jacket off entirely. I mean, what I mean by that is that you do offer a grounding, in loose terms at least, that you could call natural. I mean, obviously, it's rooted in human nature and human evolutionary history that kind of cabins where our notions of justice or of property can and cannot go. So there is a loose sense in which you are saying that this is a natural law or natural rights kind of an argument. It's just not necessarily as tightly ordered as we might imagine such an argument to be.
No, I think that's a great way to describe it. Yes.
Hey, this is Nick. We've got a few questions on the line.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for an interesting discussion. I apologize. I came in a little bit late, so I hope I'm not asking a question that has been addressed. But from what I'm listening, it's okay. The basic fundamental question is, what is the source of property? And I've listened to the different philosophies, but isn't this, my question primarily, isn't this basically an origin of the source of law? Who is the source of law? Is it man, or is it God, in a sense? And if we go with the law of nature and of nature's God, a specific legal term of art that meant, the law of the nature of the being of the thing, and the law of nature's God was actually special revelation, a term used for the Bible, that law, property ownership would sort of be obvious, because if there's a command to not steal, you can't, it logically presupposes property ownership. But if we begin with man, we're sort of stuck on this trajectory of, well, which man determines the origin of what this law is, and we'll be forever debating this. And that at some point, do we have to not choose what is going to be the ultimate buck stops here, origin of law to begin with, to even resolve these kinds of questions? I hope that was a question, and I can be muted just to hear the answer. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, let's start with the easy ones. Just kidding. I think the way to think of my project is that somehow, however you want to organize how kind of law works, it has to work within this species. and so how is it that our mind works with this concept of property, in my case, that I'm interested in? Or how is it the mind works with law would be a more generic question moving off of this project. That's a big question. I think part of the way to parse what you're getting at is that it's kind of posed as either or, and I don't think that has to be the case. And part of that, however you want to kind of have it, the abstract ideas of what you consider to be good and evil, and how you interact with people, that can't be taken away from. Separated from, has to work within this particular biological species called Homo sapiens. And so how to integrate those two things, I think, is the essence of your question. I think it's important that however you're going to think about it in the abstract sense of what is good behavior, good conduct, and what is bad conduct in law, or and in property, that it has to work with our particular way of the world, the way it works. And I think that those, as Tim mentioned earlier, I think I'm trying to make the case that there is a standard human way of thinking about property in things, that we put ourselves in the thing, that we think of where the thing goes, so goes our property in it, and that is the kind of the abstract core of it. Now, how all of the other kind of cultural things that we add to that to decide what those are, what's good and bad conduct involving things, that's a big open process that it's wide open to be explored. But
yeah, and I've got a follow up for this because on one hand, I think the easy answer is, well, what you're inquiring into is not necessarily whether God created these rules of property, but rather how he did so, assuming he did so. Because you could ask the same kind of question of, for instance, a medical doctor about medicine. Well, didn't God create the human body in this way? And the doctor would answer, well, yeah, sure, okay, well, I accept that. But now what I'm really addressing is how the medicine works, given that that's the case. So the existence or non-existence of God or his commands isn't directly relevant to what you're getting at in your book. But on the other hand, I think the part of the question was, as you know, that property has to arise from something deeper than human choice. If for no other reason that if it were just a matter of human choice, then the authority figure who's parceling out individual rights is stuck with sort of an infinite regress problem. If I'm the king and I'm deciding who gets rights to what and what kind of rights every person gets, then I will be just forever occupied figuring out whether you have a right to wear a hat on Tuesday, or whether you have a right to wear a hat on Wednesday, or whether you have a right to wear a red hat instead of a blue hat. And so, you know, and then that's all you ever do and you never get finished. So there's this infinite regress problem that makes it really impossible to view property as something that's a top down ordered system. So I think what you're arguing then is very consistent with the idea that property rules have to arise from something deeper than simple human choice.
And it's, I think an important part of it is to embed it in a community of people who are all moving around and interacting with each other, and every now and then they're going to bump into each other.
Yeah, right.
And
the world of limited resources.
Right, and we're setting up the rules by which we're going to try to minimize those bumping into each other, and the rules of property are one of those kind of things that come out of that to kind of maintain it. And so it's, I would argue, part of the process. We like to think of going back to this individual, right? Individual choice. And I think this is a very economic way of thinking about anything. But what Adam Smith has got me thinking, and out of that, is to put it into a community of people moving around and doing things. There aren't a bunch of I's. There are a bunch of we. You learn the I through the we. And so the we part of property, the we part of all these setting these rules is a starting point that that there's going to be order coming out of this. So take a non-mortal species. You know, you have all these other animals. You have deer who get into these antler banging fights, but that's there to settle disputes. They don't actually have to kill each other. And so there's some order that comes out of those, all of those processes, so as to keep the community and population of deer from dying out. And I think that's similar to what we're doing, except now we've got this whole thing called morality on top of it with property. We got to have these rules come out of this. Otherwise, the community's not going to be a community anymore.
Nick, do we have any further questions?
We do. We have two more.
Thank you for the presentation. And I think, assuming that the human being is the only species that is interested in property, is a little inaccurate, because cats, the domestic cats, have observed humanity and they actually function this way. They're very advanced. But it brings up an issue of what sets property terms. And I would suggest in our current cultures throughout the world, a very modern idea, and that's the domino theory. That there's a set of dominoes, and if you knock a domino, you get the up point. And we're going to see this in the application of law in California with Prop 15. There was a group of people that felt that if you knock the domino down of wealthy owners of, say, a shopping center, the next domino that will fall is taxes on the house, the residential portion. So they really did fight tooth and nail to win in a very, very close contest. And part of it did involve differential values. Without that taxation, we can have better schools. So there is different values. But the key to understanding why they won was the people who did win made the argument of dominoes. If this domino of your property right fails, what's next? And I think that's a great way to ask. In looking at how humans relate culturally, they're often fighting over property on borders. Nations do this. And this concept of, you know, if you have the upper hand, it also takes place in law and economics as well. So I wanted to see if you guys had any comments.
Yeah, so, I mean, power certainly is a part of this, of how disputes get settled and what becomes the rule. And so that's certainly part of the equation.
It reminds me of and I guess this gets back to a part of the tension that I felt in reading the book, and that is Hayek in Law, Legislation, and Liberty. He seems to waver over this problem. That's a real problem for somebody who takes sort of the evolutionary approach to this, which is some things are going to evolve in your process of social evolution that are simply unacceptable, that are intolerable, not because they conflict with something within the culture, but because they are profoundly wrong, period. And we can use slavery as our example. And I think Hayek's answer is very unsatisfying, because in volume 3 of his book, he says, well, you know, there's an important role to be played by people who come in and impose a top-down vision of what the world is supposed to look like, which, of course, is true and completely contradicts everything that he said in the previous two volumes, right? So I think there's this concern that if we just focus on evolution, we have a sort of naturalistic fallacy, or as I said, Panglossian fallacy problem, where you say, well, how is it possible for something to evolve that is nevertheless deeply immoral, even if everybody else in the society accepts it?
Humans are messy, and humans are fallible, and there's no guarantee in these processes that the good and the right will prevail.
Nick, any questions?
Yep, we've got one more, and we're coming up on the hour, so that's perfect. This will be our last question.
Yes, thanks. Golly, so many fascinating areas. I guess I've got several questions. Pick and choose which ones you want to address, and I'll try to be quick. But so first, the idea of mixing oneself with material from the storehouse of nature to create ownership and property, I'd have to dust off my marks, but I thought that was an idea that actually was present in his thought, and was part of his ground for the idea of alienation. I'm curious if that got integrated into your research. Echoing some of the thoughts that the first caller raised, I'm also curious about to what extent maybe the development of this concept of property and ownership could sort of be thought of as a discovery of a truth, in the sense that, you know, at some point, presumably human beings discovered mathematics. We didn't invent mathematics, arguably, rather we discovered it. We discovered it as a truth. And that sort of seems to have been one of the fundamental precepts of the whole common law project to begin with. And then finally, with respect to the analysis of slavery, I think it's something that most everyone would condemn in this day and age. But I think a lot of the analysis has been kind of facile, not limiting it to this conversation. But, you know, if a society accepts the existence or morality of the draft, for example, for military service, I think there's got to be some nuanced disentanglement of that. So I don't know, whichever of those comments or questions you'd care to react to, I'd be interested in your answer.
I want to start with the first one, because it's after I completed the book, I realized kind of that might help me understand some of these really modern tensions. And and I think you hit on the one with Marx. I'm working on a project now taking the basic principles in The Wealth of Nations and breaking them down in a way such that they could be translated into any language. And in doing so and integrating it, thinking through this book, I realized here's what made the essential tension that Marx is understanding, and that if you're the capitalist and you have put yourself into your tools and you've created these things, and then you hire the laborer and the laborer is in there working in there, but we also have this ancient tradition that when I create something, I create tools, that is mine. We have now got this process in place. We have two conflicting ideas of mine. That the worker has got the mine in the thing they created, but also the capitalist who created the tools that made it possible in order for the worker in order to make something is claiming the thing is mine through a derivative process. And that's at the heart of the issue. Who gets to claim this? And so I think that this kind of way of thinking about it is puts the question down a little, Mark, a little bit deeper to understanding the basic tension that Marx brought to this system of commerce.
Yeah, and on top of that, to take the second point that the caller asked, and this makes, I think, a really good concluding point for us, and that is the idea that property is something that is discovered, like mathematics, as opposed to simply invented. I think that's one of the overriding messages of your book, and one that I very much welcome. I some years ago, in working on my own book on property, I went over the books that had been published so far, and very few of them really get into this. A lot of them spend time on history and, of course, the economic consequences of healthy or unhealthy property rights regimes. But the idea that property is a discovery of the natural world, something like fire, that can release these amazing amounts of energy from the material world around us, and that and could be overlooked conceivably by a society to their detriment. That's an idea that's very profound, and I wish that more law students and political science students would attend to it.
Yeah, that's a great summary.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. I'm really glad that we had this conversation about your book, and I hope people will pick it up and investigate not just what you have to say, but the sources that you cite in the book that are very intriguing and offer some real new insights that are, you know, this is all very philosophical, and the lawyers who were, if any lawyers were on the call, they probably were asking, where are the discussions, legal precedents, and so forth. And you do get into that. I have a ton of questions. I have I wanted to ask you how intellectual property works in all of this, and then you talk about cases like Pearson versus Post. So I don't want people to think that there is no law in this book, but it's very important that people have a grounding in what property means in order to address these profound constitutional law questions and tort law questions about private property.
That's a great way to summarize, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this. This has been a great fun.
All right. Talk to you again soon.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, all. This is Nick, and thank you both for calling in today, and thanks to the audience for calling in and participating, for your great questions. As always, we welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. As always, check your emails on our website for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls. We actually have one coming up here in about an hour, so tune into that, same number, at about 1 hour. And well, thank you all for calling in today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.